your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast, presented by Aiken Law. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, June 22nd, 2025. Well, what a great weekend for the Chicago White Sox, and I mean that. After losing eight straight games and visiting Toronto, a place they have only won once in the last three seasons, the White Sox surprised to easily win on Friday night. Then on Sunday, with the series on the line, the White Sox got some defensive bad luck from the Blue Jays, and Miguel Vargas pulled through with a game-winning hit. Grant Taylor got his first career save. In this episode, we'll recap what went down in Toronto, including the Blue Jays really need pitching help, especially on the starting side, and should probably include a text to Chris Getz about the availability of Adrian Hauser. Speaking of trade ideas, the White Sox might be willing to eat some contract cash in order to move Luis Robert and Andrew Benintendi. We'll make cases on who is more likely to be moved at this point of the season. The White Sox return home this week to face National League West foes in the Arizona Diamondbacks and San Francisco Giants. We'll preview the upcoming Diamondback series and finally talk about what's going on in Major League Baseball. If you had to vote for the American League MVP, who would you pick? Lots to discuss, so let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And Jim, before this weekend, as we preview the White Sox-Blue Jays series, didn't have high hopes because we mentioned just how well Toronto hits at home. And they did show flashes of that, especially Bo Bichette against the White Sox this past weekend. But you mentioned that if the White Sox are going to surprise the Blue Jays, they would have to score runs, like try to score more than five. And they did that in the first game. They were able to win on Sunday by scoring four runs. And big thanks to Miguel Vargas. He went 3-for-11 in the series, but he had two hits on Sunday, including that game-winning hit with the bases loaded, tied 2-2 to pull through with a two-run single. Vargas this year with runners in scoring position has an 850 OPS. He has 13 walks and just four strikeouts. Jim, with the game on the line in that high leverage situation for a hitter, are you gaining more confidence than Miguel Vargas to pull through for the White Sox?
I think so, or at least I would say that, you know, he established a reason to have confidence in him and he's sustaining that, which I think is maybe more important than, you know, gaining confidence, is that he kind of jumped out to this early form, like once he made the much ballyhooed hand adjustment, once he got there, and it plays in all situations. It plays when they bring in righties to face him, and that's really cool. I think if you're looking for like a drawback, or if you're looking for something where you might say like, still room for improvement, or, you know, he's limited in certain regards, I would say like that, you know, I wish the fly balls traveled a little bit farther. Like there are still a case where you think he gets all of it. And, you know, like in the case of, Nathan Lukes flagging it down on the warning track, like with a really nice catch, took a great effort, but still didn't have like the incredible raw power that, you know, it seemed like it might have off the bat. So, you know, that's, I guess, not necessarily a criticism at this point because he's hitting well around it. He's doing like great with swing decisions. It's more a matter of like, if that's how he's limited, so be it. But, you know, he hits the ball hard enough to play third base. You know, now that he's playing more first base, we'll see. Like, we talked about the 25 homer mark for him. And yeah, if he goes to first base and that's his regular home, he'll have to do a little bit more to get there to support the drop down the defensive spectrum. But in terms of him getting good pitches to hit, or, you know, selecting good pitches to hit, in this case, like this, the game winning hit, he fouled off multiple better pitches to hit than the one he actually was able to do damage on. So, you know, on one hand, you could say, oh, that's not great that he's missing multiple mistakes. On the other hand, it shows a little bit of, flexibility with this hit tool, that even if he's out in front, keep the hands back, you know, one hand a ball for a single, and get production there. So I think you're seeing enough variety with how he can approach pitches to where, yeah, I think, you know, probably him as much as anybody else, especially if you factor in righties versus lefties, like Benintendi is up there when he's facing a righty against lefty, maybe not so much as Vargas against anybody. So yeah, it's a hat tip to him.
James, the White Sox wanted Vargas to gain more weight, whether that's just weight overall or muscle. I imagine muscle. But they wanted him to get stronger this offseason, to generate more power. To Jim's point, there's a lot of fly balls that are dying at the warning track for Miguel Vargas. Have you heard from the White Sox if he's meeting their goals internally to see a surge in power from Miguel Vargas this season?
I mean, of course. I think quite transparently. I mean, Vargas, I was reading like Eric's Longenhagen's old report about him on Fangraphs, and that like the ultimate projection was a 60 hit, 45 power. Like he was always supposed to have a little bit below average raw power. Part of like him getting stronger is like he had to translate to power, but it was probably going to see it as much in his hit tool as anything, because he was literally like the extra movement he was doing with his hands last season they were trying to combat was like literally just like his body winding up to swing the bat hard. So it was like creating this extra movement that made him even more vulnerable to fastballs in the zone. And then getting to the place where he could even make this hitting adjustment was him being stronger and needing less of a drawback move to do it. And thus they like started up higher and just like, hey, just go shoot straight to the ball because you can generate enough force without like this extra part of your path to load up. So yeah, this is kind of like the profile and why it like answer your question. Like, yeah, if there are runners on, I would love to have him up because he doesn't strike out very much. He doesn't chase very much. He might, you know, walk and, you know, put the game in the hands of the inferior hitter. I guess that's always a risk, but he's someone who's probably going to put the ball in play. And he's not at that level of like every time he comes up to bat, he's dangerous. It looks like he's going to get to 20 home runs this year, which is, I think, really good for him. I want to say great for him in terms of like what the raw pop was supposed to be and what even like the ideal shape of his production is going to be, which is like maybe he's not a 300 hitter, but someone who can sit 270, 280 and take a lot of walks and, you know, add like a slightly above average slug on top of that just because he's making so much good contact. Like the idea that he could get to his power was not built on like, you know, he's going to pull the ball a ton or have like his power hitter approach. It's just like he barrels it up so frequently that, you know, his best shots are going to come and they're going to accumulate over the season, but he's not really like a big power guy at any point. So if anything, like he had the deep fly out, you know, in that game Sunday. And I kind of thought with Vargas, the way his, you know, at bats have gone, I was like, all right, he's on it. He's probably going to have another at bat, good at bat over the course of this game. Whereas like if Adam Dunn, even peak Adam Dunn, like hits a ball really deep and like finds out the warning track, you kind of think like maybe we missed our chance because like it's easy, he's got like two more strikeouts coming in this game, and that was like the one moment he was on time. So for Vargas, I think it's generally all arrow pointing up, even if like the profile just doesn't suggest it's going to ever be a 30 home run guy. I do want to say like that at bat that Jim was talking about was just so funny. He did all the hard thing extremely well. He like fouled off 98 at the letters. He scooped up a breaking ball that was probably below the zone, and then he like fouled off the pitches where if like Vinny Capra like hit it for a two-run single, you'd have to be like, oh, can't throw a major league hit or something there, like kind of the thing, like any if any hitter on the lineup's process let him to get that pitch, like you'd think he has a chance, and he kind of biffed those and he weren't, they're like he's maybe the only yeah, one of the few people in the lineup that who could have recovered from the things he did earlier in that bat because he spoiled things they all to get. Yeah
that was Tim Elko's. That was like Tim Elko's way to be a major leaguer was hitting those pitches. And once the opportunity bypassed, I'm like, oh, well, see in Charlotte's versus being able to hang on other pitches. Is Vargas's like approach to power? There isn't one player who said this, but they always say home runs come by accident. And it does seem like he's maybe the guy who all his home runs are the pull field. So it's not like he's not like an Isak Paredes case to where like he's going to crank 440 foot homers over the train tracks in Minute Maid Field of regularity, but in terms of when the home run contact launch angle exit velocity is there, like it tends to go in that direction versus, having the ability to poke the ball to right center, which I think is probably one of those things where he is going to be more doubles and homers, because he doesn't have that ability to get the ball to right field, but he doesn't sell out for pull power the way others do.
Yeah, he's not quite Brooks Baldwin in like home runs or accidents, while in the middle of like the biggest heater of your professional life to date. But he's more on the level of like, oh, I'm just trying to hit the ball hard. Oh, I'm a baseball player. Like, yeah, that's something I can do. I can hit home runs. Like, it's not, you know, a surprise to me or anything like that. But also, like, I'm just trying to be a hitter, stuff like that. Like the more general, like I'm trying to be able to do everything approach. He like is more likely to be overly boastful of what he can do on the base pass than I think, like in terms of what he can do power wise.
So with this conversation, there's a player that comes to mind, Jim. Is this like Avisail Garcia then profile? Somebody who I'm happy with the progress that Vargas has made this year. And he has turned around. It's a season and career.
Oh, in but terms like, of like power,
like we're always like, come on, okay. How does Avi not hit more than 25 homers?
I think Miguel's probably activating.
Understand.
What he has,
and Avi never did.
And he's good at activating. Whereas Avi is like, hits a lot of balls on the ground. And one time he elevates it, he hits like the farthest home run you've seen in your life.
Yeah, because it's not I haven't looked up Vargas's ground ball rate, but just like from the eye test, I don't think it's terribly high where Avi had like ridiculous.
He is sub 30 right now. Rates. He is doing
sub 30.
Yeah,
okay.
He's any power hitter would kill for that level.
Right. So he's putting the ball in the air and he's getting good results. Maybe more home run power is there. And that's where director of hitting Ryan Fuller, maybe the biomechanics team, that's the next step that they take with Vargas as far as adjustments. Maybe that's more of an off season thing and next spring training.
More rice and beans?
More rice and beans. creatine, whatever it takes. But he's been hitting so well, especially in these high leverage situations and with runners in scoring position. Chuck Garfine of CHSN tweeted out, like, Vargas's numbers with runners in scoring position and two outs is even better than his 850 OPS with runners in scoring position. But it does seem like with the game on the line, like it was on Sunday for the White Sox, taking advantage of that opportunity where, Jim, the Blue Jays went very White Sox. Poor Jeff Hoffman. I mean, that is like a 35-mile-per-hour exit velocity ground ball that Benintendi hit. And it five-holed Hoffman. It just like, it was a circus.
Yeah. I don't know if he was trying to do the scoop. Like, it looked like he didn't know whether he had enough time to collect the ball and flip it, you know, with Benintendi's wheels. Like, you could sense the thunder of Benintendi's hooves going up the first base line, and it scared him. But yeah, it looked like there was like a little flinch at the end to where like maybe he tried to call a late audible and just do a glove scoop, but his body was not in position for it. Yeah. So the ball just went underneath him. Cause I think he was planning to do more of just a go straight down and then flip with my hand. And then it almost looked like there was a case of, all right, now I got to angle my body to go in the direction of first base. And only one half of his body was lined up for it.
The extra spin at the end really made it. Cause he's like, it was all like momentum up until that point, and then there's just more like, where's the ball, and like one more spin, like
yep, almost like break dancing a little bit, like now's not the time, Jeff.
Well, the White Sox got that second chance and Vargas pulled through, and the White Sox pulled through to win that game and win the series. And it's an interesting series, especially for someone like Grant Taylor, who started this series as the opener. He pitched the first inning of Friday's game, in which the White Sox easily won that game. And then he closed on Sunday, picking up his first save. And James, I wonder moving forward, because the White Sox have used Grant Taylor in a variety of ways so far to get him some major league experience. But now that he is one for one in save opportunities, and he looked really good doing so against the Blue Jays on Sunday, if he's destined to be the White Sox closer, do the White Sox just keep him in that role for the rest of the season?
What do we feel the closer role is in 2025?
Well, some teams still use the traditional model where they're having their guy pitching the ninth inning all the time. I hate to make this comparison. Venable seems to subscribe to the Pedro Grifol methodology of, I don't have closers, I have high leverage relievers. And if the most high leverage situation based on my calculations is coming up in the seventh or eighth inning, Taylor's going to be my first guy out there.
Right.
So, and I guess
I think that that strategy has more merit than tagging it with just it's Pedro Grifol's idea in perpetuity. So I think he's going to be at the top of the leverage ladder going forward. I don't think that's going to be like he's Zach Britton sitting in the bullpen, like as the game like melts away sort of situation. But also because of his workload restrictions, I don't think he'll take like the true signature of like a Pedro Grifol usage of like, here you are into the absolute teeth of the lineup at the like most disadvantageous situation, like maybe three nights
that's,
in a row.
That's Grifol.
While you're struggling, yeah, sort of thing. So like he did a back-to-back and he's now done a two out of three. Like, so I don't think it's ever going to be like closer in the sense of like, you know, it hikes up his workload because they have, you know, four straight games of save situations or something like that. I don't think they would like strain whatever constraints they have on him based on that level of closer role. And I don't think it would be, we're going to let him sit around and not pitch because we've lost eight straight games and we're just getting like annihilated in all of them. Not that any closer would necessarily do that, but I think they would still use him regularly. So I think you're going to see him hop up to maybe what they were using. Maybe not quite Clevinger because they're kind of overusing Clevinger in the first weeks of the season. I think you're going to see telltale indications that he's like the top leverage arm. You kind of already did with them having him face the top of the Blue Jays order in the ninth inning of this game. I think they felt pretty clear that that was their best available option. I don't think it was a situation of, you know, I don't even like, oh, Steven Wilson, we want to stay away from him. Otherwise he'd be in front of Taylor. I think they went to what they probably thought was going to be the most, no doubt bulletproof option already. And I think we'll see a bit more of that. I don't think it's ever going to get that close to like strict closer usage. I wouldn't like dissuade you from picking him up in fantasy for that reason, but I also don't think like, it's necessarily that's what his job is now. And they're going to put a CL next to his like name on the roster.
Does that make history tracking Jim weird if the White Sox suddenly don't care about saves?
Probably the other teams do not care about saves. For the Hall of Fame.
We've already seen it in terms of like the White Sox not saving games last year. There have been a couple of years where they've been in real anonymity, like the Jake Petrichka year of just here's your closer. Here's a guy who happens to get like the clean innings against lower leverage parts of the lineup. And it happens to be the ninth inning, but yeah, I mean, I've never been, or I shouldn't say I've never been a fan, but like the strict usage of the closer has long bothered me. The unwillingness to like let or identify guys as closer material and non-closer material has bothered me. I guess the purest example would be Craig Kimbrel coming over and then being unable to pitch the eighth, even though like I don't believe that was the reason why he was struggling. But you know, you'd see like Hall of Fame, future Hall of Famer Craig Kimbrel, who is a delicate flower who cannot pitch an inning before he's used to. Just like that's always annoyed me. And you know, when you have conversations about like, is Joe Nathan a Hall of Famer because he pitched 800 innings? And then he sucked in the playoffs. Like, nope, I would like to get away from that to where, you know, the pitchers are not stretched out into really valuable territory where they can handle two innings by themselves or can come in earlier and put out the most, just volatile part of the game. Like that's what I'd want to see happen more. So I'm fine with it happening with Taylor and such. I think just right now, I don't mind him being in the closer role because it is a way to have him start with clean innings and not throw him into situations where he has to clean up somebody else's mess when he's just getting acclimated. And also it gives a chance to, you know, not use him if they want to give him 2-3 days of rest. And yeah, the performances or the situations that would go to like Jordan Leisure or something like that, anywhere from the sixth to eighth. Like, I don't want to see Taylor fall into that where, you know, it's tempting to use him 3 or 4 days in a row. So if they want to put him in this very regimented use case, at least for like a couple months, just to make sure that he's maintaining his stuff and, you know, is able to struggle a little bit, have his slumps and bounce back from him. Then that's a case where, yeah, I don't mind him being in the ninth inning case and then, you know, breaking glass, you know, if he shows that he's, you know, all this is way, you know, not maybe too easy for him, but like he's perfectly suited to handle all leverage situations because his stuff is so good.
There's already 23 relievers in Major League Baseball this season that have 10 or more saves. I don't think anyone of the White Sox is reaching 10 saves, but it's a thought. Like, if you believe that Grant Taylor is going to be number one on the leverage ladder, as James mentioned, should Taylor be saved more often, just be used in closer situations to close out when the White Sox have leads in the ninth inning? But it does raise the point of the White Sox don't often have the lead in the ninth innings to close. He should still
or use they're leading Taylor. By 5 runs.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
You know, they win blowouts, so it's like that's part of the reason why they haven't accrued saves is because when they win too big. Like even this one, like, you know, Vargas hits a 2-run single, it doesn't help their record in 1-run games.
No, no, it doesn't. Like, too many runs.
Yeah, Jersey's got to hold the runner. Just like Venable's got to goose that.
Yeah, you need Josh Rojas to run. God, he is slow. He is slow. The other thought that I have with this series, Adrian Hauser pitched really well again for the White Sox. He went 6 1/3 innings, allowed 7 hits, only 2 earned runs. He did walk 3, so lots of base runners, but was able to navigate and limit the amount of damage against him. And for the season, Hauser in 6 starts now has a 2.27 ERA. He's got 26 strikeouts at 13 walks and 35 2/3 innings, so it's not a great deal amount of strikeouts, but again, he is limiting the damage against him so far during his tenure with the White Sox. And we mentioned this in our preview episode of this series, our previous episode, the Blue Jays need pitching. And James, I wonder, should Toronto even allow Adrian Hauser to leave Canada? Like, could I almost feel like the Blue Jays could use Adrian Hauser right now more than the White Sox. The Blue Jays are in the wild card race.
I mean, sure. I don't think it's going to, like, I don't like the pieces that you see move in June. I don't know. For some reason, they're like usually bigger. You know, it's more like a more seismic change in direction that would force the market to like behave outside of its norms, which is, you know, mid to late July. So yes, I think all points are valid. I like, he pitched really good. He seems like Frank, a little bit of a diss, but not meant totally as a diss, like someone who's more valuable for the regular season than the postseason, just because like he gives you like a lot of kind of these medium quality innings, even if you worry a little bit like about matchups against like a postseason lineup. You know, certainly like a righty sinker baller, like can you stack him with lefties where you kind of get him out of there and you can't really like deploy him in a traditional start type of capacity and composing all those things, those are gonna be your worries like down the road, you know, 3-4 months. Certainly not worries of the White Sox. So like, yeah, I think it would probably be better to get like, you know, even like thinking of the James Shields trade, you were less like, this was when they acquired him like late May, this isn't like your next ace of the team, but this is someone to give you bulk innings. This is what you need for like the going forward the year. And that's like kind of the case for getting like your mid to back end starters, like the sooner the better, because like they really are kind of regular season valuable. That said, like, I'd be surprised if Adrian Hauser is someone who kind of breaks the norms of the market in terms of the offers kind of significantly not ticking up in the last couple of weeks as options depreciate. Theoretically, you know, being more of a model driven team now, the White Sox should be able to have a really firm price set in mind where someone could just hit it and it doesn't matter about time that it happens. But that would still be surprising. So yes, they should probably trade him. He's on a 1-year deal and he's pitching really well. I was even like texting my mom, like, man, I can't believe they got just Adrian Houser just pitching the games of his life right now for this 2025 White Sox team. What a random like occurrence, but yeah, why waste it? Not that it'd be wasted, because obviously young pitchers are getting hurt all the time and they need someone to pitch these innings. And generally it's harder, it's easier to believe that the young players are trending in the right direction when they're actually winning games. So you don't want to just be bloodless about that. But yeah, he's pitching like a trade acquisition.
Well, especially like Davis Martin and Jonathan Cannon both being out. And Martin, you know, is the on top of Cannon, it's like a multiplier of just like, ooh, that double hurts as long as Cannon's out and you're not sure how he's going to come back. And, you know, you look at the Baseball Reference page, not updated yet, but Houser was already the third most valuable White Sox behind Miguel Vargas and Shane Smith. So it's it would be hitting them where they live to have Martin out and then lose Houser, because Martin's number four. So you're just hacking entire just section from it and just hoping the tree doesn't topple down, which seems like it might. You know, Aaron Civale, I think, is poor man's Adrian Houser in the sense of he's providing innings. He's, you know, that James Shields role of, you know, getting beat up, but then dusting himself off and still going seven. You know, this is, I think, the White Sox are the team for him, the way that the White Sox were the team for James Shields when they couldn't trade him. And like, well, he's going to still throw 180 at 200 innings, and they're not going to be pretty, but somebody's got to throw him. You know, Savali, I think, meets that goal. Like, I would imagine like Savali is more of a end of July, let's see who else is around to help us just throw innings and starts, and we'll send him a guy who's Rule 5 eligible. Like, that feels like Savali, whereas like Houser right now, the way he's pitching, you know, there's maybe a little bit more for him, just with the way the curveball has really jumped out to where he might be different enough to convince teams as he starts building up starts and the league's not getting to him that there's more there.
Well, on the topic of trades, Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic, in one of his recent columns, wrote about the whispers and gossip that he's been hearing. And for the Chicago White Sox, Rosenthal wrote about how the White Sox might be willing to eat cash in order to move Andrew Benintendi and Luis Robert before the deadline. So let's play a little game, gentlemen. Let's make the case and who is more likely to move at this point of the season. And I flipped an imaginary coin and I assigned you one of these players. And James, I'm going to have you start. Make the case why Luis Robert Jr. is more likely to be traded than Andrew Benintendi.
The want is there. The desire is there. This is the side. This is the side that wants it more. This is the one that's going to dig deep to make it happen. I think one, and also probably a better argument for my sake, there's less money involved. Benintendi has the 2 other years of commitment. I think the White Sox, you kind of can maybe start like, well, certainly if you don't want to like pick up his option, we won't make you pay the buyout. Sort of like starter point, and then move up from there. I think is a bit more easy conversation to start than like, so about the remaining 30 million. Well, there's lots of schools of thought on that. So Robert has a bit more positional utility as well. You kind of have to buy into Benintendi as a bat, and then there are a lot more options for that as far as saying like, hey, do you just need someone to, you know, defense and speed center fielders get are useful all the time in the postseason. Maybe you don't trade real pitching prospects for Terrence Gore with 70 raw power, but maybe that's the part of the lottery ticket element of like you trade, you pay for plus center fielder defense prices, and you might get a, you know, scratch a ticket off, and he actually starts hitting a little bit. Not that there's anything at the moment indicating a ton of hope on that to front in terms of a bat quality, but didn't you see him run into one the other day? Why can't he run into stuff for you at some opportunistic time? So I think there's a lot of factors on my side, you know, apart from the whole not playing well element of it.
All right, Jim, so I'll flip it over to you. Make the case why Andrew Benintendi is more likely to get traded than Luis Robert.
You handed me the tougher case. I think it comes down to how much cash. With the White Sox, I'm thinking it's more along the lines of what Jerry Reinsdorf said about like his willingness to contribute to the 78 project. I might be motivated to contribute $200 million to a $2+ billion project, like 10%. In which case, like, yeah, I'll throw in $3 million for the or $3.2 million for the $32 million remaining on his deal afterwards. And so like, that would not be a move the needle at any point. But if Getz can convince Reinsdorf that Benintendi does not have a future here, especially if he does not play defense in a way that inspires confidence, if we can get out from under him no matter what, and pay half his freight, pay more than half his freight for just like another Gerald Rosado type arm of just, we might have a reliever here in 2 years. Is that something that Reinsdorf can be convinced of? Because in his current form, like, he's been traded for before a couple times. Like, teams have wanted him before, but that's when he played a decent to gold glove rewarded defense. And when he was with the Royals, and he it was a big park for him, he adjusted his hitting style to be more gap to gap, and he didn't really chase homers, and he played defense, and that was a valuable player. But if he's in this mode where he needs to pull the ball in the air because he's going to be DHing as much as he plays left field, and left field is not going to be good, then the last 2 years of the deal just could be really rough and pointless, and the White Sox could just feel like they want to DFA him and with a year and a half remaining. So I could see Getz saying, like, somebody's interested in Benintendi, we have to pay 20 million, like, just say it was remaining more than half of his remaining contract. It's better than paying all of it a year and a half from now for nothing. So pick your poison, and maybe that's enough to get it done. And I think the way he's hitting now, and if he comes cheap enough to where he's in a favorable ballpark and teams respect the bats and they like just the player that he's been and how he contributes to teams with ambition, I could see teams being like, yeah, I'll give you this reliever we weren't going to use for Benintendi at 40% of the price. So I can't make the trade. I can't make the case for him for being retail price or anything close to retail price. But if the White Sox are motivated beyond their normal, willingness to throw in cash, they might have a reason to break their normal guidelines and rules for this, because it's going to be underwater no matter what.
It's just going to be kind of sad if this is how they have to spend Ishbia's money. paying down on Benintendi and Roberts contracts in order to move them to get some type of value. I don't think it's.
It would be very funny if, like, he was the franchise record for free agent outlay, and they don't even pay all of it.
No. I don't know. I still think it's likely that Robert gets dealt. I don't know about Benintendi, even though there was whispers in the winter meetings that maybe Atlanta was interested in Andrew Benintendi. But at this point, when Atlanta's out of the race right now, they might be selling before the deadline. We'll see. I still think it's Robert, but neither have a great case right now of getting traded. But it was an interesting thought from Rosenthal, from the reporting that the White Sox are willing to do that. I just don't know how many teams are texting Chris Getz or calling him right now. Like, really? We can get Benintendi or Robert? Maybe both? Yeah, I just don't see that. So, with that said, though, we are getting ready to go for the trade deadline, and GMs have made mention that the activity is going to really pick up after the Major League Baseball draft. And the college baseball season is over as LSU won the national championship in 2 games over Coastal Carolina. We already had the MLB Draft Combine. You got the MLB Draft League. Thank you to Ryan Fuller to continue dropping breadcrumbs and where he is traveling around the country to let me know who he is working out with as possible targets for college hitters in the upcoming MLB draft for the White Sox. But if we had to build the trade board, for the White Sox, like we typically do on this podcast and the website, who is on that board for the White Sox to be most likely dealt before the deadline? Now, I've included Benintendi and I've included Robert. We made mention that Mike Tauchman is on this list. We'll see health-wise if he gets dealt, if he's actually healthy to be dealt. Adrian Hauser, we just talked about. Is Aaron Civale, Jim, a serious candidate to be traded before the deadline?
Yes, but for like an unserious return or like not anybody okay. to be banking on. Like, I think the reason for acquiring him is besides trade value is like absorbing the innings. Like,
right.
If he cost Andrew Vaughn and the Brewers made up the difference in cash, then there was no reason not to trade for him because Vaughn is not going to be providing the major league value that Savali will for a team that desperately needs innings. So like they can move him. They will probably try to move him, but I could see a case where they get some offer and it's like, we may as well keep him just because we need somebody to throw innings and starts.
Right.
And we don't want to have another situation where thinking the year where they cut Derek Holland in September and then all of a sudden they needed Derek Holland. Like it was a couple injuries hit, like they just were kind of done with him and then realized, oh, we... was that the Chris Volstead? Was that when he came up to just who's our best starter in AAA? May as well call on him. But I could see Savali fitting in that mode of he's going to be happy here because he'll get starts. He'll get the ability to showcase his worth in free agency. And we're happy to have the innings. So, yeah, I would say he can be moved, but doesn't have to be moved under any circumstances.
Yeah, we'll play the probability game in a future episode when we are in the month of July. But continuing building this trade board, James, is Josh Rojas on this trade board?
In theory, in concept, in terms of the original intentions of the assigning, play good defense, run the bases well, raise the culture, and then have a good end of the summer. It's got a 7.500 OPS. As you know, even the glove has been wonky at times. You know, someone kind of missed a month and is coming back with a broken toe. You understand it, but I don't think it's making him super appealing right now. So I can't think of it as being like, I don't know, I think he'd have to have a little upturn of looking a little bit more useful in the final month. Even if like the surface level season stats don't get good, I think he could be like a low level, a ball reliever flip of like, hey, we needed an infielder and it was July, so we made something happen type move, but not playing well enough, I would say. Like someone like, I think in that tier of like role players, like someone like Michael A. Taylor is probably looking more like, hey, that's still Michael A. Taylor, more than like someone like Rojas, who's on a similar level, but hasn't looked like himself so far.
See, I was hesitant to put Michael A. Taylor on the board, but we can. And the reason I was hesitant is that if the White Sox trade Robert, well, then I just assume Michael A. Taylor is going to play center field because you really don't have one right now to play in center field. But James does make a good point that if somebody's looking for a fourth outfielder, especially a veteran who's had postseason experience, Michael A. Taylor could be an option. The other outfielder that I had on the board. Go ahead.
Isn't your starting center fielder AAA got a 700 slug or something like that?
One Riley Brooks Baldwin.
Lying in wait.
Shaking your head. Josh is shaking his head. There's also Dominic Fletcher.
Yeah, exactly. Here we go. We're going to start the Dominic Fletcher campaign again. Really, for the White Sox, this upcoming trade deadline, we were expecting exciting times because we were hopeful that Luis Robert would bounce back and perform at a high enough level to draw really significant interest from contending teams to help with this rebuild and add more prospects to the pipeline for the White Sox, a very similar return that the White Sox got for Garrett Crochet. Now it's eating cash or Benintendi or Robert, hoping that Mike Tauchman gets healthy before the deadline. But the White Sox best trade asset is the guy they just picked up six starts ago and Adrian Hauser. That's where we're at now.
Can I add one more name to make it interesting? Because it seems like you really want to make this interesting. So I'll do that. What about Edgar Caro?
Edgar Caro? Why would you trade Edgar Caro now?
Because they have two. Oh, I'm just saying, if they have.
Why would you do such a thing, Jim? Explain yourself.
They have two catchers. If they like one more than the other, and they have Corey Lee, who's like a fine backup catcher, like if they have him around and he's, you know, hitting well enough, and Charlie's perfectly suited to be a second catcher for a second division team, and somebody comes, you know, needs a catcher of the future, and you know, they have this awkward thing of playing both catchers at the same time, and they don't want to do that for months and months and months, you know, I'll throw it out there in terms of, if they like Teal more, perhaps they move Caro at some point. Like, it seems like more of an off-season thing if they're going to do it, like more consideration, have, you know, all teams involved trying to shape their futures. And so I don't think it'd be something that's pressured by the deadline to happen. But, you know, when I watch the White Sox just keep rolling out two catchers, and Caro's power hasn't really popped. I mean, Teal's really hasn't either. But just if they like one more than the other, I could see them wanting to, yeah, being open to the right price and being like, yeah, let's do it. And all of a sudden, by surprise, they've traded Edgar Caro.
Okay.
I think I don't see Teal being the one being moved.
No, I would agree on that element. Otherwise, it's dangerous radical.
Yeah, I know. I will miss him if he's traded. Like, it's a case of, I'm not hoping he is, just trying to make it interesting for you.
All right, I'll add Edgar Caro. But right now, on June 22nd, the most interesting trade asset the White Sox have is Adrian Hauser. That's where we're at, leading up to July and the halfway point of the Major League Baseball season. Hopefully things will change, but let us know on who you would add to your White Sox trade board. And in a month after the MLB draft and during the All-Star break, we'll check in on the probability of these players moved prior to the trade deadline at the end of July. A Sox Machine public service announcement. We have brand new items in the Sox Machine store. With the weather heating up, we've got new Adidas Sox Machine polos, perfect for your company outings, casual Fridays, and of course the golf course. It's part of our media attire as well when covering events. You can grab any of these three styles that we now have in the store. We've got new Sox Machine coffee mugs to sip from while you read Jim and James in the morning, new stainless steel water bottles with the Sox Machine logo, and fanny packs, which fanny packs have been very helpful entering Major League Baseball stadiums with all the bag restrictions. Visit shop.soxmachine.com to check out the new gear. And for Sox Machine subscribers, remember your discount code to get an additional discount when checking out. Again, the URL is shop.soxmachine.com. The Chicago White Sox are back home as the Arizona Diamondbacks now visit. The Diamondbacks are 39-38 this season. They won their last game, but they are 5-5 in their last 10. They are currently fourth place in the very tough National League West, trailing San Diego and San Francisco, and of course, Los Angeles Dodgers. Offensively, the Diamondbacks are dangerous. They have a team 780 OPS this year. That's third in Major League Baseball. On the road, their team OPS is 760. That's still good for fourth in Major League Baseball. As a team, they've hit 110 home runs. That's in the top five of baseball. They've hit 140 doubles. That's second in Major League Baseball. They've hit 17 triples this year as a team. That's also second in Major League Baseball. So offensively, Arizona is scary. On the pitching side, these numbers are scary. The starter ERA for the Diamondbacks is 4.53. That's 25th in Major League Baseball. And they don't have Corbin Burns for the rest of this season. The bullpen, worse. The reliever ERA for Arizona is 5.25. That's 27th in Major League Baseball. On the road, when you add in both starters and reliever ERA, the Diamondbacks as a team have a 5.07 ERA on the road this year. That is bottom five in Major League Baseball. Notable players, though, again, offensively, Eugenio Suarez already has 25 homers this year with his 890 OPS. Corbin Carroll has 20 home runs this year with his 914 OPS. Slow start because of injury, but Ketel Marte has 13 homers this year, and his season OPS is over 1,000. Your probable pitchers for this series, Monday night is going to be hot. The temperature high in Chicago is 97 degrees for Monday. We'll see how hot it is at Wrigley Field. First pitch is at 6:40 p.m. Central Time. Left-hander Eduardo Rodriguez takes the ball for Arizona against Shane Smith for the White Sox. Tuesday night, 6:40 p.m. Central Time, Ryan Nelson against Sean Burke. And Wednesday afternoon at 1:10, it is Zach Gallen against to be announced for the White Sox. And Jim and James, with this Diamondbacks series, what's interesting from my point of view is I'm curious to see on how the Diamondbacks offense looks in person, because that has been a surprise in how well, especially in the power front, that they are hitting. But when Chris Getz took over and he was assembling his front office, James, we kept hearing about this idea that the White Sox wanted to model themselves more to be like the Arizona Diamondbacks, in which the Diamondbacks shocked the National League, won the pennant, and played against the Texas Rangers in the World Series. That team did not have a lot of power. They beat you by getting on base and stealing bases and being very aggressive base runners. Well, now they're hitting the ball out of the ballpark, and they're hitting it all over the field for extra base power. So are the Diamondbacks still the model, James, that Chris Getz in his front office want to mold the future White Sox contending offense to be like?
The offense, not the starting pitching falling apart element of it?
Not the pitching. No. That has gone way
Sure. I would say, like, I think the logical connection between, like, the super athletic, like, really good defending team of 2023 that they kind of more clearly are aping is that if you have an athletic group, like, you maybe uncover more surprises in terms of power developing down the road as those players stick and get more reps in, whereas where you draft the kind of polished, lesser athletic but proven performers, once the bat withers, you kind of see, like, that all the value has gone with it. So I think the idea of let's get a bunch of springy guys with, like, who are athletic and have quick wrists and stuff like that and all sorts of these good athletic tendencies, maybe we're going to find more hitting ability, especially as they have, like, a longer runway to establish themselves because they can run and defend and justify their presence on the field before they hit, and you maybe uncover a little bit more offensive capability just from having a lot of toolsy guys around would be, I guess, the logical through line for that. I don't know if you can, there are dribs and drabs of that in the system, I feel. You know, Kyle Teal's pretty good catcher athlete. Brady Montgomery certainly that mold. George Walco is kind of, I don't know, he's a freak athlete. Whether or not he'll be a freak athlete in terms of positional versatility when he's, you know, 6'7", he remains to be seen. So there are spurts of that. There's examples they can point to. I'm sure, you know, when Chris Getz talks to the media Monday, he'll talk about, you know, a couple of particular projects that he feels are particularly exemplifying the direction they're doing, even if that's not super representative, like, the entire system. Like, Brady Montgomery is pretty much kind of a man apart as far as, like, what their hitting prospects look like. By and large, you have a lot of kind of fire hydrant type infielders that either hit a little differently or exactly how you think people their size would hit. But yeah, I think they're probably closer to aping the 2023 Diamondbacks than 2025 by a long shot. And it's still more, let's see a couple more drafts that really come into fruition before we can buy into it. But sure, that would be nice. Find a Corbin Carroll any day now. That'd be swell.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point, because in the National League, not only Corbin Carroll, but Pete Crow Armstrong on the other side of town is now a serious National League MVP candidate for his ability, not only defensively in center field, but he already has hit more than 20 home runs this season. Is it that simple, Jim, to completely just change the draft strategy and hoping that you take these prep athletic outfielders that demonstrate tremendous skill, that they're going to be plus defenders, and hope that you could develop into hitters like Corbin Carroll has for Arizona and Pete Crow Armstrong for the Cubs?
I was thinking about that when looking at Andrew Vaughn's career and, you know, after the trade and talking to him in Nashville and just looking at what the White Sox could have done differently. And yeah, you know, you were on it in terms of CJ Abrams at the time. Yeah. You were stacking them directly, saying, do you go with the proven college bat who can only do one thing defensively, or do you go with the prep shortstop? You know, prep shortstops have a pretty good first round record in terms of turning into decent to great ball players. So why not Abrams? And then you look down and just like Corbin Carroll at 16 is the best player after the Rutschman-Witt pairing in the first round. And it's the same thing of just a high school player, middle of the field, very talented and athletic. And the Diamondbacks have really gotten the most possible out of them so far. So it's something to consider as the White Sox go into this draft, and they're kind of in this prep shortstop territory. And there aren't a whole lot of, I guess Gavin Kylan would be the proven bats. And you might say that, he's been underappreciated in a Tennessee lineup that, they just been so stacked that it's, he can kind of sneak under the radar. And then you kind of think, well, it's kind of Jacob Gonzalez in terms of the, ready bats who, without a whole lot of upside or, a whole lot of, power pop, shortstop abilities that you really want to put that first round pick on him when you need the best possible player. So I think this one should be telling in terms of whether they're willing to not look at a first round pick, especially one in the top 10, and saying we need to get major league production as soon as possible. We cannot resist going the Zach Collins route, the Nick Madrigal, the Jake Berger of, we can see this guy in the majors in 2 to 3 years versus taking a slightly longer term project. And the way some of these guys are going, like sometimes it seems that the good ones do get to the majors in like 3 years, even from high school. They're making their debuts at 21. And so I think the White Sox, it would behoove them to be in that mode of thinking, we can do that. They don't want to count on that, but why not us if we feel like we've made strides in our hitting development with more to come? So here's hoping.
Yeah, we'll see how Corbin Carroll does against the White Sox. Again, it's going to be hot at Wrigley Field. So if the ball is traveling out of the ballpark, Arizona has proved this season that they are well-equipped to take advantage of that opportunity. So as Jim mentioned in our previous episode, the key for the White Sox, score! Keep scoring! I'm not expecting low offensive output from Arizona this series against the White Sox. But again, we'll recap this series in our next podcast episode, which we will record on Wednesday night and have that ready for you guys on Thursday morning, as we'll preview the weekend series as Flo Rida is going to be playing a post-game concert on Friday night later this week after the White Sox and Giants game. James is so excited. He will not be missing that concert. He'll be there in attendance, so you can go party with James at the Flo Rida concert. And as we usually do for the Monday episodes, we take a look around Major League Baseball with our final segment. And this is really the story that's grabbing national headlines. Cal Raleigh carrying my fantasy baseball team this year. Thank you, Cal. He's got 31 home runs this year. He's on pace to hit 66 home runs. And his OPS is over 1,000. And he's a catcher. Like, we haven't seen this type of power production from a catcher in a long time. And he's got a chance to set some records for the position on the power side. Aaron Judge is still Aaron Judge. Judge has 27 homers this year. His OPS is inching closer to 1,200, which is just crazy. Bobby Witt Jr. is having a good season. And Tarek Skubal is still leading the pack as far as the American League Cy Young, but he is the fourth most valuable player in terms of WAR in the American League. So if you had a vote for the American League MVP, who would you vote for? And I put this out on Twitter as far as the poll, and I'll share the results in a moment. But Jim, I'll start with you. If you had to vote for American League MVP, who would get your vote?
It would be Aaron Judge, but I would get the argument for Raleigh. Like, it reminded me a little bit of, I had to look up the year, but it was 2016, and the American League Rookie of the Year went to Michael Fulmer, as it should, but Gary Sanchez was second. And Gary Sanchez, that was the year where he hit 20 homers in 53 games. And he got 4 first place votes. And I remember at the time people were saying, Fulmer's thrown 160 innings. Why isn't he? He should be the one going away. He's provided so much value. He's been there all season. And, you know, there was the whole East Coast bias, Yankee bias type thing. But I also remember just Sanchez being a phenomenon and understanding the argument that I can see this being, like, considered the year of Gary Sanchez. Like, that just the way he announced himself in that moment, slugging 657, pretty compelling case. Like, I think Fulmer should have won it, but I like that it wasn't unanimous and that Sanchez got some representation. So I think it's kind of the same thing where Judge has established this, like, just track record that he's established. And so it's natural to kind of be inclined to maybe, who else is out there? Who else can we give it to? The kind of MVP fatigue. But when you have a catcher who's on pace for 60 plus homers, that's pretty freakish and special and memorable, the way that, like, Judge's, you know, one great Judge year can blend into another. So if he got some first place nods, even if he came up, like, you know, two wins short or whatever, you know, the margin is to make Judge the comfortable MVP without getting into, like, you know, arguments over defensive metrics or catcher versus anybody else. Like, I could see, you know, Rally getting some votes in the Sanchez model. I mean, like, yeah, I get it. This was the year of Cal Rally, even though Judge was the better player.
How about you, James? We don't know yet if you will have an American League MVP vote, but at this recording, you don't know if you do. So if you had to vote, who would you pick?
I was wondering if you were going to, like, pose this question in some way that gave me, like, an out, but no, it was more very specifically, like, how would you vote in this specific situation? I would wait until the season ended because that would give me all the
time. Oh, okay.
I think I'm... One, I've had the MVP vote twice. Both times I felt like, oh, this is, like, legitimately a hard choice, and then put my vote and realized that I was, like, part of a unanimous MVP vote each time, and kind of, like, thought, like, man, maybe I should have broken with the group. Like, I certainly thought Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was, I think, 2021 was his MVP caliber season, and maybe whatever year it was, I think it was 2021.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 2020 when they made the playoffs, or they were in the playoff race until very end. I guess they didn't make the playoffs. Like, was it more was there some level of value to him being a bat in the middle of an order of a team that was, like, fighting in contention? That should be factored in, like, just the level of, like, critical moments that you had to hit in versus, like, you know, Otani doing this, you know, practice course in record time sort of nature of us having an elite season for the Angels. Like, ultimately, I was like, the value is just so clear. Like, one is, like, an offensive bat first position, like, clearly as a first baseman, versus, like, a guy doing it both ways. Like, maybe I could get more like a great hitting center fielder, more that could put me over the edge of, like, who led a team to, like, a division championship. Maybe I could get some sort of, like, non-statistical argument going there. But, like, I thought the value was too great. I wound up voting for Otani and then realized, like, I could have, you know, one, I either would have been at odds with the nation of Japan, or I would have, like, made 10 grand in that week alone of just going on Japanese television and, like, being mocked and not even understanding it.
Or leaning kind of into myself. It.
And then, like, you're becoming a just a full heel, like, coming out multiple weeks in advance, like, afterwards, and just kind of make a small little living off of that. And then the second one was, like, I think it was last year, of Aaron Judge over Bobby Witt Jr., which is, like, yeah, Judge is, like, clearly just a level of hitter beyond everyone else to a degree where it feels like it's a little bit grooved. But, like, man, if you watch Bobby Witt, what a player. He does it all. Like, is there some value of just, like, this is the greatest watch in the league? And also, you know, I mean, they both were, you know, the best player on a team that made the playoffs. And so I'm trying to, like, get away, because I think, one, there's a level of writer group think for, like, this is the right answer and we all have to do this. And I think that feeds into the fans of, like, anybody who doesn't vote for that, like, this is an idiot who should get their vote taken away, to which I generally say, like, come and take it, please, gladly, get this off my face.
There are two ways to say come and take it, and there's one that's aggressive and one that's plaintiff, and I think you're going to,
like, if you just stop tweeting profanities and send, like, two politely worded emails, like, maybe it can happen, but instead you're wasting both of our time here on social media. I would be open to the argument of like, we've never been able to fully properly statistically value catchers. That's shown in how rarely that they're MVP when they are respected as such a critical role in the team. Cal Raleigh probably is like as unimpeachable it gets in terms of like having a tremendous value of like defensively and having a lot of, you know, being revered by that pitching staff and having a lot of responsibility for him to come and also have like the greatest catching offensive season of all time. And knowing, as I've waded into my vote before, the New York Yankee guy will get more than his share of support, no matter how well he's producing. I could see myself throwing a Raleigh vote in that aspect. As I get like emails about like why I haven't like voted the second high best Yankee player high enough in response. So yeah, I could probably go Raleigh in such a situation where that was not my vote, and thus I was not discussing it ahead of time casting ballot on a published medium. Or, you know, maybe I have that and the BBWA won't let me vote for awards anymore. And that'll just be a shame to not get to do that.
So on Twitter, the poll, who would you vote for American League MVP right now? Aaron Judge got 49% of the vote. Cal Raleigh, 47%. So really close. Bobby Witt Jr., Tarik Skubal got crumbs. Did you say Eisert?
Yeah. Who did you think I said?
10th place votes.
Wow.
Did you see the eighth inning, man?
Jane. You know what? I hope you do get an American League MVP vote so we can revisit this topic at the end of the season and who you voted for and see if anything changed.
By the way, looking at the American League Rookie of the Year voting, Fulmer 1, Sanchez 2, Tyler Naquin 3, Chris Devensky 4th. Wow, then you get to Edwin Diaz number 5, and that's like hits in Tim Anderson number 7. So like Anderson barely cracking. It's like that's you know, especially when it comes to that particular award, like in the end doesn't matter that much. And then you look at the NL, Corey Seager, Trey Turner, Kent Maeda, Trevor Story.
Yeah,
so sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes legacies are started and sometimes it's a weird blip.
Yeah, this year, I mean, Shane Smith is in the top 3 probably for American League Rookie of the Year, but it looks like it's Jack Wilson right now as we approach the halfway mark of winning the award for the American League Rookie of the Year. But American League MVP be really interesting in the second half of this season, especially if both Aaron Judge and Cal Raleigh can get to 60 home runs this year. Raleigh putting together, again, one of the best. Maybe he's got a chance of putting together the best offensive season ever by a catcher in Major League Baseball.
Did you realize beforehand that the White Sox had at one point employed the majority of the 2016 AL Rookie of the Year vote getters?
I didn't realize that until you mentioned it.
Naquin, Debetsky, Mazara, and Anderson.
Yeah, I forgot about Naquin. Yeah, he does topple it to the majority. Yeah.
Wow. All right. On that, a future episode, remember some guys. Jim, what's catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
The big stuff, Dodgers, Padres, always like the, you know, as much as I don't like the whole, I'm going to hit a guy for flipping a bat or he had success off me, so I'm going to throw at him. Don't like that. I do like the politics, like genuinely interested in the politics of throwing at a guy to protect him from reckless pitchers or pitchers who aren't good enough to throw inside and your guy gets hit too often. Like the whole, you know, Carlos Quentin charging Zach Greinke type argument of like some guys get hit a lot and then something, you know, causes them to just go berserker mode. And, you know, like the psychology and the politics of accepting hit by pitches as just the cost of doing business versus your guys are too wild against our best hitters. You were one pitch away from losing our hitter for 3 months because of a broken hand or wrist and somebody has to pay. Like I always enjoy that drama. I always feel like there's an element of thought that isn't there when it comes to like the just getting mad because one guy got hit and you have an eye for an eye type treatment. So always like reading about that and hearing the quotes and thinking about it for myself. Also the Devers stuff as it unfolds in Boston, all the drama there David Ortiz showing unread text messages. You know, just he's a, yeah. The more I think about it, the more I read about it, at first I was like, yeah, yeah, Devers kind of, you know, dug his own hole by not accepting position changes when he's being paid that much. But then when you read about how weird Boston is, you realize like he got paid top dollar. And now he gets to go to San Francisco, who seem at least less weird. Yeah, they're still, they've had some change and turnover as well. But I think like with Buster Posey, it is more probably of a, I appreciate good major league players type approach versus whatever Boston's been doing. You know, they have a whole, they have a very weird power structure. And then when you see like David Ortiz coming in, adding like an extra element of just why is he being like the attack dog for the front office right now. You know, Breslow's, you know, riding the back seat. You have Alex Cora, who has a lot of power. I don't know exactly how it's going to shake out because it doesn't seem like Breslow has a ton of fans for a brand new GM. Like he did not come in with a mandate apparently, or like he's trying to establish one, but they talk about how they're a bunch of holdovers who hate him. So what's that going to look like? Is it going to be another situation where, you know, just he makes too many unpopular moves to ever get people on his side? But I mean, like that job chews people up and spits them out. Like Charrington, it happened to him, you know, Bloom, it happened to him. Like, so it'd be new that it happened to a former big leaguer who, you know, seemed to understand the nature of the market versus, you know, the kind of, you know, Ivy leaguer model that, you know, is naturally mocked in some corners. So, I have no, real investment aside from seeing, you know, Garrett Crochet and Lucas Giolito being happy and productive. Like I like seeing them do well, but in terms of, what's, you know, the most entertaining, yeah, it, having a huge mess in Boston is, I think, as entertaining as it gets for off-field stuff and just senseless. Why do people care? Why are all these knives coming out from all these different directions? I'm glad I don't have to cover it because I think it'd just be exhausting as somebody who gets bored quickly of it happening to, you know, we've seen with the White Sox, and yeah, it's a drag when that's all you have to talk about, but from the outside, a lot of fun.
Yeah, but you just found the Yasmani Grandal play that he threatened Pedro Grifol.
I like going back to it. Yeah. New details. Oh, speaking of the other thing I was going to say about the Dodgers, Michael Kopech still has a spike catching problem.
Oh.
Like it's, he had a costly run scoring balk at the base load, like he just, where he catches the spike, does the cartwheel on the mound, and then gets mad about it and like, yips. Still Michael Kopech, so that was my other wrinkle for the Dodgers Padres stuff.
Yeah, the Red Sox are 40-39. They're fourth place, but they are playing better baseball as of late. They're not dead yet. But James, how about you? What is catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
When I was at Globe Life last weekend, like so I was talking to someone that came up, they were like, I don't understand how the Angels are playing as well as they are. That team looks really bad. And right now, as we speak, the Angels are 2.5 games out of the last wild card spot. They're 3 games under. And
what?
Yeah, when they played the White Sox at the start of this year, I certainly thought the White Sox were going to win that series, really up until the end. And if you like look at the Angels roster, I mean, any conception you had, like, one, I didn't think the Angels were going to be any good this start of this year, just them being 37-40. In any fashion, would have been a surprise to me. But also, if you like look at the roster, like I don't think anything you thought would go well that would lead to them overperforming has happened. Trout got hurt. Yoan Moncada like has randomly like given them like 100 good at bats and is now on the IL for the second time. Jorge Soler just got hurt. He wasn't good before that either. You thought that would probably be the way they got it. They spent a lot of money on Robert Stevenson last offseason. They were supposed to get him back this year. He's been hurt. Who else has been hurt? Like Chris Taylor, who they signed, just got hurt. Ben Joyce, who was really cool like the first couple of weeks, like throwing 105, hurt because that's a painful thing to do. They've been bringing up like top pitching prospects like Caden Dana and Sam Allegheri for like to fill out the bullpen at random intervals of the season that people can't understand. Ron Washington, if you thought this was like Ron Washington magic making them good, he just took a medical leave of absence. that also like has him at the game. So people are like, the timeline for that's a little murky at this juncture. They got Christian Moore, who, you know, it always seemed like they were going to call up and like rush into playing time. Basically, they're starting second baseman now and like has a 550 OPS, and he does like an awesome thing once a week because he's an exciting prospect, but he also has a 550 OPS because he's a prospect, because Tim Anderson didn't work out of the wall at all. Joe Adell is like randomly, like he's still striking out a ton, and like I don't think you can count on him to be on base, but like he's slugging enough to kind of be worth putting out there and is no longer a train wreck defender. I think Nolan Shanwell, who I just thought of like low power first baseman, I don't know if there's anything I could be less interested in the world, but he's hitting all right in a way that's kind of propping him up. Zach Nato, who I thought like was kind of the reason Tim Anderson made that roster, because of his shoulder injury, and you don't necessarily know how quickly he's going to come off of it shoulder injury wise, but he's hit for power right away. But you still kind of look, it's the fourth worst like run differential AL. Kyle Hendricks is in the rotation, which, you know, is neat, I guess, from a, you know, archival standpoint, but as far as competitiveness, I don't know how sustainable it is. They should fall apart, but I don't know. Why can't the White Sox have random seasons where they outperform the run differential by like 5 to 10 wins for half a season? I guess they've done that, you know, 10 years ago, but it feels like it's been a while in a way that I'm interested to see how this House of Cards both falls apart, but also catches on fire in the middle of falling apart.
Well, and the other fascinating thing about the Angels, too, is that Baseball America just had its updated organizational winning percentages, and the Angels are dead last in minor league winning percentage, 402 winning percentage, negative 369 run differential collectively, by far the worst. So it feels like they're running on like negative margins at the major leagues, and they have like nothing in the minors. Like I see it's, you know, most closely like watching the Southern League standings, because the Barons have been they just lost a grueling first half fight, but like part of the reason why they lost is because the Rocket City Trash Pandas, who are the Angels AA affiliate, just lost 9 in a row, including all 7 games to the team that the Barons are chasing, Chattanooga. So like having seen that and then realizing like, oh, this is the entire system is just it's Trash Pandas all the way down. Yeah. And they're barely, you know, staying afloat at the major league level. So it feels like if it does collapse, it's going to be hard.
They also have like terminal White Sox poisoning. You know, we already mentioned Moncada, but like Yolmer Sanchez is like regularly playing for the AAA affiliate. Carson Fulmer and Tookie Dessant are down there. They obviously have Jake Eaters still bouncing around. They signed Sammy Peralta. Like the level of cross contamination going on there, like you have to at least keep an eye on them. I don't know if they're telling us about their future, the future or the past, or like just seeing an alternate dimension and the portal is ripped open and you can stare inside it if you want to, but what you see changes you. So yeah, they're catching my eye across the baseball world, Josh, to sum it up.
You missed the biggest one. Oscar Colas.
Oscar Colas.
Yeah, not
Colas could be called
not a triple A. Or I've seen him at double A.
He's the one biffing that Rocket City series.
Yeah, but I've seen on Twitter Angels writers suggesting that if the Angels need an outfielder, there's Oscar Colas.
Bless their hearts.
That'd be something.
That is his trade.
Oh, man. Well, let us know in the comments section what's catching your guys' attention around Major League Baseball outside of the White Sox. But thank you so much for listening to this extended edition of the Sox Machine podcast presented by Aiken Law. You can subscribe to the Sox Machine podcast wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen to the show and also watch our other videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Our most recent video broke down Noah Schultz's first AAA start, taking a look at his StatCast data. So if you didn't get a chance to see that start and want to know how he did, Jim and I recorded that video. And you can check it out again on youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at SoxMachine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. Follow us on Blue Sky. We're at SoxMachine.com. James is JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. And I am Josh.SoxMachine.com on Blue Sky. If you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball. You can sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. That gets you an ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. Also unlocks the comment section for you as well. We also have additional tiers of support. We also have some spots available in our Veterans Committee. We're going to have a sweet night in August for our VC members. And they also have access to our group chat where they can pester James questions all the time about what James is hearing in the clubhouse and what the White Sox could possibly do in either the draft or in the upcoming trade deadline. So again, if that's something that you're interested in and you'd love to help support us, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.